Today on Vox Talks Economics, PhD advisors and their students' research success. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. Getting accepted to an elite PhD programme with a superstar advisor would seem to be a big step on the road to a successful research career in economics. But is it? How productive will those young talented economists become? And if we want them to go on to publish their research consistently, can their programmes or advisors do a better job of helping that to happen? Josh Angrist of MIT and Mark Diederichs, formerly of the Rockwell Foundation Berlin, just transferred to the University of Passau, have studied the economics PhD education production function at elite universities in the US. So welcome to Vox Talks Economics, Josh.
Thanks, great to be here.
And Mark as well.
Hello, Tim.
Tell me about these elite PhD courses, first of all. So which universities are we discussing? Why are we considering them to be elite?
So the elites for us are Berkeley, Chicago, Harvard, MIT, Northwestern, Princeton, Stanford, and Yale. And that's kind of the list that's on every PhD applicants at the top of their list if they're looking to do an econ PhD at a top program and they want to become academics themselves, then generally they want to go to one of these programs. Of course, many people go to other programs. There are many other successful programs, but lots of people aspire to go to these. And the graduates of these programs account for a very large share of publications in our leading journals. So it seems natural to target these. They're super selective. And they're part of our research, academic world culture, where the purpose of PhD education is to get a job as an academic and to do scholarship, to write papers for a living, as I tell my students.
You say they're super selective. For anyone who's thinking about this in their future, how difficult is it to elbow your way onto one of these programs?
Very difficult. I don't know the details for schools other than MIT, but MIT gets something like 800 to 1,000 credible applications and is only going to offer seats to a few dozen of those, or maybe 30 or something like that.
You're looking into their research output after they complete their PhDs. Why should we care if these talented young economists, why should we care if they go on to publish and how much they publish after they finish on these courses?
We care, meaning academics like me and Mark, because that's what we think we're doing. We think we're training PhDs for a lifetime of scholarship. And that's really what people come to MIT to do. It's true that some go to industry or some end up in industry and many go to government. But the culture of the place is that we're training you to write papers, meaning writing journal articles. And the purpose of writing journal articles is to reach your scholar peers with your findings and to also build your career as an academic and eventually get tenure and so on. That's really the objective of these programs. And so it's interesting to ask how successful they are at doing that.
It's fair to say that Josh has been a successful scholar. In 2021, when he was one of the winners of that year's Economics Nobel, we spoke to his co-author Steve Pishka about his work and the work of his co-recipients David Card and Guido Imbens. Listen again to our episode, Why Natural Experiments Won the Nobel, from December 2021.
So the point of this research is to look at how successful that they have been in publishing, but not to start with the advisors and the teachers that they're going to be exposed to on these courses. How successful have the faculty been on these courses at publishing compared to perhaps their peers at other universities?
Well, if you're at a top program in our data, by definition, you're an extremely successful academic. And most of the advisors are somewhat more senior, meaning they're not just young faculty, but they're people that have established themselves and gotten tenure. So those people, by definition, have been very successful and have published a lot of papers. I think one of the things that's kind of surprising to people like me and my friends and colleagues is how few of our students are as successful as we are in a research sense, how few of our students have long careers as scholars or even any kind of career as a scholar. An even rarer outcome, and you could see this on the Math Genealogy website, which is fun to play with, where you can find me and my advisors and my students and their advisees. I have many children in the sense of having many PhD students, but I have very few grandchildren.
That's very counterintuitive because of how you have described these courses. So we're going to get into what the numbers are on that. You have researched in this paper the output of the students, the advisees in this relationship. Where is the data for that? What period did you pick? How many of them are there?
We are focusing on 10,000 PhD students that wrote a thesis classified as economics, and they graduated between 1989 and 2023. But then we continued to refine the sample. So we are excluding all those students whose thesis got classified as economics, but who actually graduated from a different program, such as history or so.
Okay.
And then we also stopped in 2017 to allow for 6 years post-graduation period. And yeah, we are combining a lot of different data sources to come up with a really comprehensive sample of PhD students. So we started out by using the ProQuest database, but then we added administrative spreadsheets. We also added data from the Mass Genealogy Project. And then we had a pretty good feeling about the completeness of our sample. However, we still needed to add the relationships to their advisors. So we had the issue for a long time that we could only identify one advisor using those data sources that I just described. So we continued by downloading all of the dissertation PDFs and read through the acknowledgement section using the GPT API, which allowed us to identify mostly three advisors for all of our students.
I think it's important to emphasize, and Mark is too modest here, that it turns out to be very hard to find out who people's advisors are. The written record often only has one, but we know from our own experience that that's not true. And it's surprisingly poorly tracked. And even in my own department, we have these Excel spreadsheets and they're quite incomplete, and ProQuest may only list one. So we spent an enormous amount of time and effort trying to read the PDFs, and we're using our basic AI and text processing tools, and we're trying to figure out, by virtue of who you acknowledge and who you thank, whether that's your advisor, and then we try to validate that. So there was a huge, huge, huge project there that was very time-consuming, and we had a great staff of research assistants to help us.
Well, I mean, it's a very important and a very significant relationship.
Yes, and it's surprising how poorly documented it is.
Yeah.
And we would partly validate the data informally. I would show the list. I'd say, well, here's your students. Can you tell me whether this seems right? I'd tell a colleague or a friend or a co-author. And then they'd say, well, but so-and-so is my student, and they're not here. And then, you know, I'd have to say, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but there's no record of any kind that's your advisee. And they didn't even thank you in their thesis. And so there's some awkward moments there.
As Josh pointed out, it's surprising that many of these students are not as successful at publishing as their advisors. But how unsuccessful are they at publishing their research?
On average, the students have about 1.5 publications in good journals during the 6 years after they graduated. However, the distribution is very skewed. So some have many and others have very few, or many also have no publications at all. So 60% of the students in our sample have at least one publication in a decent journal. So those are the 140 highly ranking economic outlets from EconLit. And about 50% of the students have two publications or more, but looking at longer time horizons of 15 or 20 years.
And we're talking about the top journals. We are not talking about the top five here.
No, no. When we say top journals, we call these the deep impact journalist because they're based on a paper that I wrote with colleagues a few years ago about the impact of economics on other schools. And we identified sort of relevant journals. So the relevant journals are the 140 most cited by papers in the AEA journals, specifically the AER actually for that. So it's a pretty deep list. And a lot of the journals that are towards the bottom of that list are not thought of as great journals. But you know, they're still respectable journals and they're indexed and so on.
So basically, if you're looking at someone who's on one of those programs and you don't know very much about them, it's a coin flip whether they're going to publish at all.
Yep, pretty close to that, sort of unconditionally. Many of them will not publish. And even the ones that do, they don't publish much and they're kind of done with whatever they're going to do by 10 years post-PhD. Almost everybody's done.
Is this because there's just not very much space in journals? How does this compare to the students who were on those less competitive programs?
Well, we haven't looked at that, but there's a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives from 2014 that shows that people who complete degrees at less selective programs often do about as well as people who'd finish from the elites. And even within the elites, there's kind of a ranking that most people would say, well, MIT and Harvard and Stanford are at the top. But actually, graduates of Northwestern and Princeton do about as well. And it is much harder to get into MIT than to get into Northwestern, Princeton, or Yale, because getting in means you get funded.
Yeah.
But students at all of our programs are quite similar in terms of their ultimate success.
It's a skewed distribution, so some do particularly well. Is there anything about them or an attribute of their advisors that we could look at and say that's why they're doing well?
That's something that we set out to characterize. So it's not so much about the students for us. We're looking at features of the advisors and the advising relationship. Is the advisor themselves a very successful scholar? And are they prolific advisors in the sense that they have a lot of students? And we have a great plot on this showing advisors against the number of students. There's some really outlying advisors that have incredible numbers of students and really shape the profession by that. And schools, especially the elites, kind of compete to attract those advisors. But it's not clear that having such an advisor is a causal effect in terms of what it does for me. It could be that the best students kind of find those advisors, and then those are people that were going to do well anyway. Our analysis is roughly consistent with that theory, that it's a lot of sorting, and there's not much of a causal effect. Like when a highly prolific advisor moves to a new department or school, you don't see that the success of those graduates go way up from that school.
Absolutely. Now, is it that the advisor might be able to co-author a paper, put their name on it, and then it's more likely to get published? Is there an effect in that way? I would assume that there was.
So that's nothing that we do have in our data. So to answer this question, we would need to have acceptance rates of journals. Mm. However, what we can do is to look at whether students that have a co-authored paper with their advisors have higher publication success after their PhD. And what we find here is that this is actually not the case once we condition on having at least one publication. So if you compare those students with a co-authored paper with their advisor with those other students that also happen to have a publication before they graduated, they are doing similarly post-graduation.
You also had a look at cohort size. For people who don't know, what is a typical cohort size, and are the smaller ones better as an incubator to help students publish?
So the cohort size for us is the class size, the number of graduates in a given year getting degrees. And that varies by school. Berkeley is big with about 36 students a year in our data. That's in economics department grads, and then there's another four or so from related programs like the policy school or the business school. MIT is on the middle of with about 26 over our period, and some of the other schools are smaller, like Yale is a little smaller, Princeton's a little smaller. One of the trends that motivates us to think about class size is that at MIT and Harvard, the super elites, you might say, class size has actually fallen quite a bit in the last 15 years or so. That was a deliberate choice, and the argument was that we have a better program when we have a smaller class. That also reflects funding constraints because people now take 6 years to do PhDs. When I was a PhD student, it took four mostly. And so graduate students are 50% more expensive. But setting aside the cost issue, we don't see a relationship between class size and research success. And my feeling is that the programs, I don't know if we would want to have 1,000 PhD students a year, but we could certainly have 50. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the success of the graduates would be diminished by that. Our data don't suggest that there's any diminishing return to class size.
Right. So put very roughly, if you had twice as many students, then you would get twice as many publications afterwards.
Exactly. And I think that would be good for economics. And it would also open up opportunities to students who are not currently getting into these programs. There's been a lot of discussion about diversity and letting in more diverse applicants into PhD programs, whether it's women or minorities. And the scope for doing that at a school like MIT is exceedingly small because the program is so small. If we took twice as many students, we could do more of that. And I don't think it would lead our program to produce less successful graduates.
So do you know what happens to these missing scholars, the ones who are not publishing? Do you know that they are trying and failing to publish because they just don't manage to hit on the right subjects or have the right ability, or do they find something else that they would rather do?
You know, we don't have a direct measure of that. Mark and I have discussed how we could find those people. It would be harder and it wouldn't be quite as systematic in the sense that it's not going to be in a standard database. We'd have to track them down one by one. So we've not embarked on that.
Do you have a feeling about it?
Well, I know that people do get discouraged. I think that the other thing to kind of understand about these programs is that the atmosphere of the program is we're training you for scholarship. And so almost everybody sets out wanting to be a scholar, but then maybe they don't get an academic job. But even if they don't, they're still expected to publish a paper. And many non-academic employers would like you to do that and will support that. And so they must be failing at that or not persisting at it a fair number. And again, they get kind of give up. Of course, they go on to have fine lives. So I'm not saying they're failures. You know, they go on to successful careers in industry and government and various worthy endeavors, and they make a good living. But it's not the thing that they really came here to do or be. And there's kind of a puzzle there. And Mark and I collected a lot of interesting data on, as you mentioned, Tim, you know, co-authoring with students, co-authoring with faculty. At a descriptive level, it does seem to be a good idea to write papers with a faculty member. But any graduate student who's precocious and writes papers at an early stage seems to do better. Of course, that could also be selection. It doesn't have to be a causal effect. And then we looked at other aspects of the advising relationship, like the advising load and extreme measures of that and co-authoring with classmates. We also have something called research affinity, which is whether your thesis cites your advisor. So that's just a basic way of saying, are you doing work that's kind of related to what your advisor does? You know, in the sciences, it's a very different world that I interact with at MIT. First of all, they admit students who want to come to work with a particular professor in a particular domain. They don't just admit you, say, to do a PhD in mechanical engineering and then you do whatever you want. You have to get into somebody's lab. And economics is more freewheeling and the students are pretty much left to make their own choices there. And so some students maybe end up on working on something that's not really very well related to what their advisor does. So I'm interested in that as an advisor.
What can we learn from this? I take your point, Josh, that it's very hard to find causal relationships here. But what insights can we have from this research into elite departments about how they can successfully increase student research output?
Well, we don't have too many prescriptions except, well, maybe the one I mentioned about it would be good to make the programs bigger.
Yeah.
And by doing that, kind of by definition, you're being somewhat less selective. But then it turns out that our ex ante predictors aren't super highly predictive ex post of who's going to be a good scholar. So we should just take more chances. I think also we need to come to terms with something that our data suggests is that there's kind of an analogy between professional scholarship and professional sports. It's very hard to predict who's going to be a top NBA basketball player or a top baseball, football, or soccer player. Even if you play well in college, maybe you even play for Ohio State or a Big Ten school, you're not likely to have a career in the NFL or the NBA. Scholarship is a little bit like that. There's a few outliers that produce a lot and other people have shorter careers. Now, of course, there are other things you can do and there are worthy activities like you can teach in a liberal arts college and so on. But the scholarship game is very skewed and driven by a few relatively strong players. And that suggests a whole bunch of things. One is this idea about just having more people trying to do it and hoping to see more success. Another is to come to grips with that and recognize that a lot of what we train people to do is not to be academics. And that's another reason to do more of it, but I think also to fund it somewhat less generously. many of the people we're training are going to go to very, very high wage careers in consulting and finance. And the current elite graduate education model in both the US and Europe is that this is paid for essentially by taxpayers. If we're training people to go work in Amazon's economics department, by the way, it has a very large economics department.
It does.
With hundreds of economists. And they're making a good living. It's not clear to me why the taxpayers should fund that.
Okay, so look at it from the other end of the telescope. Mark, you were quite recently a student. So based on this research, is there anything that students can learn if they want to succeed and publish regularly? Any insights from this that will help them to do that?
These two-stage least squares estimates that we show in our paper show that there's a small causal effect of advisors that publish many papers themselves on their students' productivity. So it makes sense from a student's perspective to try to seek mentorship from very good and prolific researchers. And then talking from my own experience, and that's also something that the data shows, is that it's really good if you manage to publish something during your PhD. This, I think, gives you insights about the publication process that can be very valuable also after you finished your PhD. Of course, this is very difficult to do. It makes sense to also look for mentors that are experts on the field of research that you also want to pursue as a student. So if you are citing your advisor, this means that you are probably interested in the same research topics. And I think this is also very helpful to look for mentors that are experts on the field that you are trying to conduct research on.
To use Josh's family tree metaphor, choose your parents wisely.
Exactly.
This is one case where you can do that.
Yes, just one. Thank you very much, both of you, for talking to me about this. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much, Tim.
And Josh.
Thanks. Great talking to you, Tim.
The paper is called Dissertation Paths, Advisors and Students in the Economics Research Production Function, and it is NBER Working Paper 33281 if you want to look it up that way. There is also a Vox EU column about it called Prolific PhD Advisors Are No Guarantee of Graduate Student Research Success. That's published on the 16th of February 2025.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, what is geoeconomics? And what questions can it answer?